do something that is different. And you look at all the heroes, and that's what they do.
The commitment to listen with the same passion with which we want to be heard.
In terms of who do you want to be, articulate that. Mm-hmm. Find the words behind that. Who do you want to be?
Welcome to another episode of the DNA of Purpose podcast. Now, today, I am absolutely thrilled to welcome back to the studio the remarkable Paul Zak. Now, to give you all a little bit of background, Paul is a professor at Claremont Graduate University and is ranked among the top 3% of most cited scientists with over 200 published papers and more than 20,000 citations to his research. Paul was one of the pioneering scientists to integrate neuroscience and economics into the groundbreaking field of neuroeconomics. Along the way, he has also helped establish interdisciplinary fields such as neuromanagement and neuromarketing. He has authored 3 popular books and is also a regular TED speaker. Now, in today's episode, we are going to be diving into Paul's latest book, Immersion: The Science of the Extraordinary and Source of Happiness. Now, this book uncovers the neurological foundations of extraordinary experiences using insights from 50,000 brain measurements to guide readers on creating high impact marketing, entertainment, training, customer and employee experiences. It demonstrates how extraordinary experiences not only boost customer lifetime value, but also provide the neurological basis for increased individual happiness. So why is this so important? In an era defined by disruptive trends, exponential technological progress, a fundamental shift in work dynamics, and an urgent need to address climate change, it has never been more important for purpose-driven leaders to create deeply moving and extraordinary human experiences. And today we will discover exactly how we can go about achieving this. Paul Zak, welcome back to the podcast. It is such a joy to have you joining me today.
What a pleasure to spend another hour with you, Rebecca. Thank you.
Oh, look, the pleasure is all mine. I absolutely loved our first conversation. And the bonus for anyone listening to today's episode is that they will be able to listen to this one and then loop back to that one to hear more of your genius and more of your wisdom. But I'm going to kick off with a question today that I ask all of my guests. And I think for you as a scientist, this question may even be more significant. It is simply this: what question is currently guiding your life and your work forwards at this point in time?
I think the key question I focused on now is happiness.
Yeah.
How do we build lives in which we are engaged, happy, healthy, and our length of life is extended? So health, happiness, happiness affects all those. So we can just call it happiness. But isn't that the big question in life?
Yeah, 100%. And increasingly so. I think, you know, we're really beginning to see trends emerging around things such as loneliness, mental health issues. There's a whole slew of reasons why we feel increasingly disconnected, which makes that very question around how we become more connected, more fulfilled, and more happy even more significant.
And also, I think it's essential for businesses, now that we live in the experience economy, to create extraordinary experiences for customers. So my new religion is customer lifetime value, CLV. If I can wow you with my product or service, what we've shown neurologically is that creates not only this peak immersion experience, this great pleasure, but creates a craving to repeat that experience. That's just CLV. And finally, in the happiness realm, when we have these peak immersion experiences, we begin to kind of flex the brain's muscle to be more emotionally open, more connected to people around us. Mm. So it's a real sacred duty, I think, that organizations have to create these amazing experiences.
100%. Now, Paul, you just referenced the experience economy, and I'd love to touch on that because I think it's something that sets up the relevance of today's conversation. So as a starting point, I'd love it if you'd be able to firstly define for us what you mean by immersion and why is this body of research more important today than ever before?
Perfect. So immersion is, I'm using this in a technical sense, a capital I. This is a 1 second frequency set of signals that come out of the brain that we can measure using a variety of techniques. And currently we can do that from smartwatches by applying algorithms. Turns out your head is connected to the rest of your body. So we carefully mapped out how that evaluation mechanism for social emotional experiences, which is what immersion is, can be captured from the peripheral nervous system. So if we are competing for customer time, attention, and dollars, I don't want to have a bad experience. No one disagrees on that. So that competition now is less on commodities and much more on adding experiences that. Even the greeter at Walmart is trying to create a great experience. Yes, they're there for security and all that, but also it's a nice old person who lives in your neighborhood who says hello to you. So I was working recently with a very high-end restaurant chain and food was extraordinary. I mean, just extraordinary. In fact, I got to take my open check, take your daughter, let's measure immersion, which we did. And we found was that food great, service in the first 45 minutes great, and then it really dropped off. They didn't send me out with I sent $250 for lunch for two people. You should be thrilled. Mm. I should be your favorite customer ever. You should recommend that you take a picture. Hey, you guys must be celebrating something. Let's take a photo. Would you like me? The wait staff didn't even try at the end. They just want to get rid of me. I'm like, well, that is a lost opportunity, right? It started out wonderful and the data showed that. And then why are they missing out the opportunity to send me off with an amazing experience? So again, not a bad experience. It was fine. It could have been better. And so if I want to compete for that, those dollars and that wow experience, hey, you just spent $250 for lunch. Let's post it right now on Instagram. Why didn't they recommend that? Hey, we'll take a photo of you. Here's the name of the restaurant behind your head. Is that your daughter? Awesome. Is it her birthday? Why are you guys here? And there's so many opportunities to reinforce that great experience that you've had. Like, oh yeah. So a lot of restaurants now, high-end restaurants, will have that kind of thing you see like at the Oscars or whatever, you know, this kind of wall with the name of the restaurant where you can take a photo behind it, you know, the black curtain with the company name on it.
Yeah.
Like that should be in every high-end experience that you're having, in my view. You should, why not get social media? I mean, 100%. What's more important than customer word of mouth? So anyway, when you see the data, you go, oh, so I could tell you that. No one disagrees, I'm sure. Well, you don't disagree with what I'm saying. But when you see the data and you go, oh, that thing just dropped like a rock after minute 45 because, you know, I mean, I ordered dessert. I ordered champagne. I was ordering, I had an open check. I'm ordering everything.
Exactly.
And they didn't plug in that this was some exciting experience. And they could have accentuated that by adding this very valuable social layer. So sorry to put a point on that, Rebecca. I'm now rambling. Whenever we have an experience, when we add a positive social layer, it increases the neurologic immersion, increases the value of that experience, which means customers are willing to pay more for that. And it creates that craving, as I said, to repeat the experience. So that social component is a true differentiator.
So there are two rabbit holes I would love to go down from what you've just shared. I'm going to start firstly with the significance of the research you're doing, because in hearing you share that example, you know, it's so interesting that many of us walk away from these experiences and we will, you know, form opinions or provide feedback. But what I love about what you're doing is this is based on real-time data. And I know that this is also a lot of the work you're doing with Immersion Lab, your business as well. So, you know, I find that really interesting because, you know, I think for anyone in the creative field, we spend so much time combing over feedback and, you know, trying to make sense of a slew of opinions, but opinions are subjective. Where the work you're doing enables people to really cut through that with actual data.
Yeah, exactly. And so I call this the Freudian hangover. We think from this whack job Freud that if I just poke you the right way, ask the right question, I can make that unconscious emotional experience conscious. It's not the way it works. I can't force your liver to tell me how it was processing breakfast. Yeah. I can't get those unconscious parts of the brain to be related consciously. But there are technologies, typically in the laboratory, but now we have one that's scalable outside the lab, that allow individuals to measure that response right here. And you know, you can see my data. I'm getting a big smile because I'm getting more value talking to you than I was at baseline. You're the best. But that adds to the experience I'm having, right? So if I was having this conversation by myself or with a, God forbid, a boring person, you know, it wouldn't be as valuable to me. And that makes me, again, want to come back and spend more time talking to you because it was a great experience last time. So by having this scalable technology that lets us measure second by second, which parts of the experience are good or bad? How good was it overall? How's it compare? As you said, I've got 50,000 brains plus on the site. So how's it compare to other similar experiences? It allows creators of content and experiences to get better at giving customers what they want. And that's the key, as opposed to NPS or something very weak, you know, measures of whether it was valuable or not. At the extremes, we know. If I'm super angry with you, Rebecca, God forbid, you know, I would know that. If I'm, I don't know, if, let's not say me. Your husband falls in love with you, hopefully he knows that. But in between, you know, is the experience I'm having right now on self-report a 7, an 8, a 3? Compared to what? Compared to my kids? Compared to my dog? I mean, I just don't know. So this creates an objective measure comparable across humans. The same scale. Neurologic firing rates are comparable across all humans. And so you can actually get really interesting data to create extraordinary experiences that people really want and will pay for.
Amazing. So you just shared your phone there with the data on it. Are you measuring that data from a smartwatch? How is that actually working?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think I'm going to dig into two parts of that for listeners. Okay, one is, what are we measuring in the brain? So in about 20 years of work funded by the U.S. government and lots of agencies, we looked at how to influence behavior. We were tasked under contract to identify signals in the brain that would allow initially soldiers, but then later health providers to actually influence people's behavior. And that's what social creatures do. We influence others. We tell stories. And so we did lots and lots of research, all published. People can just go to Google and find it. In which we found that valuation mechanism. So sorry, your brain's super lazy. And so if I convince you that the value is high enough, it'll actually invest the resources to really process this information or this experience I'm having. And so that valuation requires me being present. If I'm distracted, looking around, it's like there, but also has to require that it generates emotional value for me. So we trace this to neurotransmitters that induce electrical activity that we can measure in the lab with big machines. But as I said, because your brain is connected to your body, the signals for this valuation network I've called immersion are shown in the cranial nerves. These are the connective tissue from your brain to your peripheral nervous system. And those nerves connect all the way through your heart to the data you pick up from smartwatches. So,
and so this we is don't the care vagus what device nerve, you have. Is it? The vagus nerve?
So it's actually cranial nerve 9 and 10. So vagus nerve is cranial nerve 10. So it's actually two of the cranial nerves that we get signals from. And we know this because we use pharmaceutical studies. We traced out these pathways using drugs. Turns out, Rebecca, you can pay students to take drugs in your experiment. Who knew?
How about that?
Yeah. So anyway, once we found these signals, how do you actually use them without putting people in a lab? And we wrote code that lets infer that activity from the brain from these smartwatches. So we don't care what device you have. And that way we create a scalable technology that anybody can use to measure how good your experience is second by second. We say, so we can measure what your brain loves. And that's kind of what you want to know.
Gosh, there's so much to unpack here. What I love about what you're sharing with me right now is that, you know, I think traditionally many of us think of the brain as, you know, this kind of processing machine that lives in our head. But what I'm hearing from what you're sharing with me now is that our intelligence, for want of a better word, is something that is running up and down a superhighway through our entire system. You know, we've heard people talk about the intelligence of the gut and heart intelligence. So I'm really curious to understand the nature in which our brain is sending these messages to enable us to really experience something extraordinary, not just because we think it's extraordinary, but because we are feeling it, because that experience is in our physical body and our being.
Yeah, exactly right. So you just nailed it, that physiologic response in the brain is transmitted to the peripheral nervous system. So for good or bad, so think about... Well, you're a pro, but you know, when you get up on a stage, when I did my first TED Talk, I was so nervous. I've given a lot of talks, but like literally my knees were shaking. And it's just like, you know, those butterflies in the stomach. Well, that's just a physiologic response. That's controlled by the brain, but it tells you, oh, this is something you should be really focused on. And, you know, I survived and I did okay. But, it, you know, same thing when you... you know, I talk about this in the book. You know, you walk across a tall bridge over a canyon. Your heart rate's up. Your palms sweat a little bit. Like that is inherently just a little bit dangerous situation. You should be careful about that. And so it's giving these physiologic reminders. Your brain's giving you physiologic reminders in the body that says, hey, walk a little more carefully, you know.
I guess that's the instinctual part of us that has, you know, that kind of innate survival mechanism that's letting us know what's happening in our environment.
And I think the innovation, exactly right, the innovation we made, you know, starting 20 years ago is look at the positive side. Can we actually understand helping behaviors, generosity, trust, where our body's telling us, oh, this is totally safe. This is... you know, so that emotional resonance component comes from this neurochemical oxytocin that I'm kind of well known for discovering the behavioral effects of in humans. And it's the signal that you're someone I want to engage with. You're someone who's safe. You're someone who's okay to talk to do a project with. And if we don't have that signal, then we withdraw socially. And so, as I said in the top of the show, because I'm obsessed with happiness, much of our happiness, maybe half of it, is due to the quality of our social connections. Okay, what does that mean? How do I measure that quality? Do I ask you? Is that number of people? Is that people I say hi to every day? What's the measure? Well, the measure is in the brain. And so by creating technology, we have a new free app called Tuesday, which anyone can use to measure their social interactions, how much value your brain gets from those social interactions. They have goals. Just like you have goals for steps, let's have goals for interacting with people. And I think now with hybrid work, with small families, with, you know, more diffuse kind of social environments, we really need to be reminded, hey, you're actually not getting enough social emotional interaction to be emotionally healthy. And this is where businesses come in. If I'm, maybe I live by myself and I don't see someone because I work at home all day, when I go to that restaurant, I go to that movie with a friend, I really want that to be extraordinary because I'm craving that great emotional experience.
And I imagine some of that craving comes from a space of what it is to experience really deep emotions, something which is very important to what it is to be human. I had a read through your book last night, and I was laughing along with you because you shared a powerful example of bursting into tears whilst watching a movie on an aeroplane, which really, you sharing that story really resonated for me, because I have to say, as a mum to a six-year-old daughter, I find myself crying all the time watching movies like that. And it's something that seems to happen more frequently. I'm not sure if it's because I am a mum or because I'm getting older. Maybe you can shed some light as to why I always find myself in these kind of emotional situations. But I am curious to understand, in today's world, we're exposed to stories 24/7, some of which are going to elicit that emotion, whereas others not so much. So what I'm curious to know is, based on your research, what types of stories are likely to pull on our heartstrings and create these extraordinary experiences, and why is that so?
Yeah, so we found a number of things. So when we looked at extraordinary experiences, we use video, we use live experiences, we use training, all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And the most effective way to create a peak immersion experience and therefore influence someone's behavior is storytelling, full stop. So what does that mean? It means we find you have 15 seconds to capture attention. You got to open hot. My energy expensive brain just wants to idle. So you got to tell me, yeah, hey, this is going to be wild. This is going to be a great experience. And then you've got to introduce characters in an environment that may be different or unusual. If it's the same environment I know in my home, I'm not very interested. And then have those characters have authentic emotions. So that we're back to the kind of the movie notion. You know, in movies, you really have to have this authenticity in acting. And the same thing in any story. It could be a written story, it could be audio, it could be video. If those emotions are authentic, then we resonate with them. It generates the emotional contagion so that we get to share those experiences, hence crying in movies. And then that story's got to resolve. It's got to be a crisis. And so that kind of classic narrative arc that we learned in, you know, English 1 mm-hmm. in college is really the most effective way. And this is, you know, Aristotle.
This is your basic kind of hero's journey.
Hero's journey, yeah. Yeah. Some story where we can learn something from it and we're moved by it. Now, having said that, just to be super honest, a couple of the TV networks use our technology mm-hmm. to test new TV shows. What's the problem with linear TV? People tune out at commercials. So they know they've got to put this emotional hook in on the commercials. And before they started using our technology, they were only, even though they know that, they're only successful 40% of the time at creating this emotional hook before a commercial. So, you know, again, we're asking too much, I think, of content creators to just know intuitively somehow to feel that this mm-hmm. is going to work without actually measuring other humans. If you're a content creator, you're special, right? You're an expert in this area. That's why they hired you to create content. So you really want to ask for an audience, a sort of general human being who's not associated with the content, you know, is this a great experience or not?
Mm. So you just mentioned the importance of, I guess, what I call the cold open, like having that kind of moment of impact. What I found interesting in reading through your book is that you said that based on your research, that the brain can recognize a hit TV show or song in the first minute. Now, I found that absolutely extraordinary because whilst we can put all of the energy into creating, you know, this beautiful story arc with the peak emotional moments and all of the things, at the end of the day, if you don't get that first minute right, you've lost the eyes and ears of your audience. Can you tell me a little bit more about what is actually happening there? And whilst we can't rely on intuition, how is it that in less than a minute we know whether a show's good or not?
Isn't that wild? I don't have a great
totally
explanation
wild.
For that. It comes up, you know, consistent with the data. So it's like, you know, you can't change a first impression. If you start out the right way, then you can kind of ride that wave. And so, yeah, somehow the brain knows. Again, this is all based on unconscious emotional responses that we're measuring. And we relate that to, you know, movie ticket sales and song downloads. And it's all in published research. People can find mm-hmm. this. So part of that, Rebecca, is that there's this deep nonlinearity in the brain. And we typically think in a very linear way, you know, or even binary, good, bad. But the brain is kind of evaluating this second by second. And because it's so energy hungry, the brain has to save resources. If it's not important enough, it's just not going to put the resources into making this a great experience. So I think there's something just powerful in the very beginning that we just know.
Mm, yeah. Wow, I love that. And I think it's also interesting what you just shared in relation to how we think, particularly in an age where everything is moving at speed, that we naturally think in a linear fashion. But what you're saying is that our brain doesn't actually process the information that way.
Yeah, it's curious, right? That
yeah.
we think that we are, you know, there's no little person in your brain pulling the strings that says, hey, you know, pay attention. So, you know, in English, we have this phrase, pay attention. So attention is table stakes. I've got to first get your attention, but then I've got to get you to care about this. So one of our, I'll suppress the unpleasant word, but one of our early subscribers to our platform called Immersion, they give a shh measure. Like, I got to get you to
care about. You can use that word. We don't mind.
Okay.
You can use that word.
They give a shit about this thing. Yeah. And if you don't, your brain goes, oh, this doesn't seem very important. So again, that's that the beginning is really important. So let's go back to the restaurant example, this expensive lunch I had. We walk up, we have reservations. Immediately said, oh, here's a glass of champagne. Have a seat on the couch. Your table will be ready in a couple of minutes. Oh, I'm already happy. You didn't ask. You handed me a glass of champagne.
Yeah.
No. Let's be honest. It wasn't fabulous champagne. It was okay. It was bubbly wine. It was still really nice. It was surprising. I'm like, I'm already happy. I'm sitting on the couch. I'm not upset that my table's not ready because I got a glass of champagne. How great is that? And so, you know, that's the kind of starting out the right way that I think is a key takeaway from all this research we've done.
Paul, so far we've discussed what gets our attention and how that triggers emotion. And yet, as purpose-driven people, we're often looking to inspire action. You, in the book, talk about creating tension through the immersive experience. Can you explain what you mean by creating the kind of tension that enables someone to not only remember an experience, but to actually do something with that energy that has been created?
So let's take it into the sales realm, just to be concrete. So I'm telling you something. I'm trying to tell you about this wonderful thing I think you should buy. And what we often do is kind of close that narrative arc, tell you a story. This is the best thing ever. Everyone uses it. It's going to change your life. Everything's going to be great. And then I sort of wait. So what we find is you've got to actually create that tension. This is how this is going to change your life. This is why this is the best thing since sliced bread. Close the sale immediately at that high tension point, that high emotional point. If I can't create tension, the brain has a very strong desire just to return back to baseline where I'm just idling and I'm thinking about I'm going to buy milk on the way home or whatever. So I think from a sales perspective or a customer service perspective, I've got to really think about how do I inspire that action? And once I've captured you from a neurologic perspective, I want to move you. Now, as you know, there's a whole chapter in the book on the ethics of persuasion. As long as you can say no, you're cognitively intact. I'm not coercing you in any way. Right? It's fine. That's what humans do. We try to persuade each other all the time. I've been married 29 years. I'm still nice to my wife. I still hope that she'll stay married to me, right? I don't want to be a whatever mean bastard to her. That wouldn't be good. So I'm still trying to persuade her, right? So I think we sometimes are so in the business setting a little shy to just move right in when we've got that tension point, right? So think of this as the sort of peak emotional component, right? This is going to make your life so much better. I think you should purchase too.
I love that.
Have that conversation.
Yeah.
Early in my life, I was a shoe salesman. So I sold shoes for 2 years. dropped out of college and sold shoes. And we always say, you know, this comes in three colors. You should buy one of each. So,
Oh, what a great experience. It certainly gives you context to the work that you're doing today, which is a wonderful thing. Right. The other thing I find interesting in what you just shared is the idea of cognitive dissonance when we reach those points, I guess, in our life where something shifts in our thinking, where we have those breakthrough moments. Is that also related to that same kind of tension?
That's a good question. It's almost related to anti-tension. What we see in the scientific research is this kind of down-regulation of activity in the brain. This is like why you get good ideas when you shower.
Yeah.
You're not thinking about, you have stuff, you're back processing, and then you're just washing your hair, and then you go, all the time, right? Or taking a walk. And so this is why I think kind of daydreaming, all that's really important. So for all of us who are in the knowledge creation industry, actually just having quiet time, you know, not AirPods in your ears, just actually being alone, wandering, or maybe taking long showers. Maybe that's the solution. You actually need the brain to just allow you to not consciously process what you're doing now, typing something, but actually back process all the stuff that you've been thinking about. And by the way, sleep is essential for that, for listeners. Mm. I'm a high energy person. I used to be one of those people who are like, sleep's optional. I can go 3 days without much sleep. But it turns out, as everybody knows now, sleep is part of the immune system of the brain, keeps you from getting dementias and things like that. But also it consolidates information. And so if you're working on a hard problem, even with a deadline, getting good sleep or even taking a 20-minute nap is a great way to take the information. So sleep, you flush out a lot of information that's not relevant. But if you're working on something, sleep can provoke you to find a solution. Mm.
I can absolutely verify that. As a part of Future Crunch, we are often speaking in duos. And for that reason, we need to learn extensive scripts. And so sometimes you're working on quite short turnarounds of, say, you know, 3 or 4 days to dial up a good, you know, a good 30 minutes of script. And my brain never fails to amaze me that I will rehearse lines and get incredibly frustrated and think none of this is going in. We'll literally go to bed, wake up, and my brain has literally reorganized something and it's all of a sudden all there, like a miracle.
It is a continuous miracle. Yeah. And, you know, the writers would call it the muse spoke to me, but it's really your brain categorizing information. Like, here's all the stuff I know, and now I've got to find these connections. And by the way, it's easier to do as you get older because you have more information in your brain. So some very recent research for the people like me with some gray hair, you know, as you get older, you have so much more information. It's not that your processing speed is slower when you get older, although it slows a little bit. It's more like you're actually paging through a lot more information than when you were younger. And so you tend to answer questions more slowly, but more effectively or more precisely.
Mm. Oh, I love that. So, Paul, I think we've, you know, we've created a good baseline for our listeners to understand the concept of immersion. That said, the human experience is incredibly diverse. We come from, you know, different backgrounds with different experiences and, of course, different ways of thinking. And so I have two questions. What are some of the key differences you have observed in, say, how men versus women or people from, you know, varying backgrounds experience immersion? Are there significant variations, or are we a lot more alike than we think we are when it comes to the creation of these immersive experiences?
What a great neuroscience question, Rebecca. A plus I give you for that. Like all good questions, the answer is yes and no. So the signals we're getting are kind of deep in the brainstem, the very oldest parts of the brain that are very strongly conserved across all individuals. So we see a lot of consistency. As you know, I've done field work in Papua New Guinea and around the world. And so very, very consistent responses. Having said that, there are personality traits, which are largely genetic, that influence how immersed people are in experiences. So in particular, individuals who by personality are agreeable and empathic, they're warmer and they have a bigger emotional response for any experience. So from a kind of market research perspective, it means you want a big enough sample. And we find that's between 35 and 40 people at a minimum, so that the people who have less emotional response, who are less empathic, and those high emotional responders kind of average out. Having said that, the high emotional responders for a particular experience are your super fans. Mm. So the ability to identify super fans neurologically means you can do really effective targeting. And these super fans want to help you. They love whatever you're doing. Put them to work. I think super fans are just an underutilized resource. And you can find them because they create fan fiction or they're on your social media.
I love it. The neuro-influencers.
Oh, I love it. I'm going to steal that term from you.
You got it. Yeah, that's perfect. That's yours.
And there are some a little bit of male-female differences. So women tend to be, on average, a little bit more agreeable and empathic than men. So it's about 60-40. So there's a little skew towards women, but not a strong one.
Mm. And so, say you're a speechwriter or, you know, a creator of some description, and you've got an extremely diverse audience that you want to create an extraordinary experience for, are there tools that we can create a universal immersive experience? So something that everybody in an audience will find themselves in.
I'm going to give that a yes and no again. Mm. So what we have found in the science is that these highly emotional immersive experiences often draw on memory. And so there are cultural touchstones that can increase the immersion in an experience. We did, I think we discussed this in the book a little bit, but we did some work with health insurance, advertising for health insurance. The U.S., you know, is a fractured system, so it's very complicated. And the advertising had zero effect. They literally spent $100 million in advertising with no impact at all because they made generic commercials. They tried to address the issue you raised, which is there a universal great commercial so that people will purchase health insurance? And the short answer was no. There were specific commercials with touchstones for different social groups, ethnic groups that worked really well and some that didn't, but they didn't target those very effectively. They just put them all on linear TV and they didn't say, oh, hey, this one is specialized. So I live in California. A lot of people have Hispanic origin. Hey, let's make a commercial that uses Hispanic touchstones as opposed to a generic commercial with, you know, Asian woman and Hispanic guy and white woman and whatever. It just didn't work because it was trying to be too generic in order to, quote, save money. So in saving money, they didn't really target effectively. So I think those cultural touchstones are really important. And from the brain processing perspective, it actually recruits more of the brain when it draws on those memories, those cultural touchstones. So you're actually just investing more in that experience because it's relevant to you.
That might explain why I seem to be crying more as I get older. More experience.
Well, the kids do it. So you asked that question earlier. So I was, I'm not a very emotional person, but once my kids are raised, I cry at everything now. Bambi, mother's died, I'm crying. So what happens is when you have kids, not only you're worried about them all the time, but you actually have much larger increases in oxytocin.
Yep.
So you're just flooding yourself with oxytocin that drives up your immersion. And for men, male listeners, kids diminish your testosterone. And so you get less testosterone and more oxytocin release. And so you become, like me, a big girly man.
I love it. Big softy. So, Paul, I want to, I guess, switch gears a little bit and explore some broader themes. Now, we're clearly at an inflection point with AI, and I'd love to discuss the intersection between AI and immersion in a moment. But first, what I'd love to explore is around what makes us uniquely human in this, you know, in these interesting times with AI, because while AI has a, you know, quote unquote, seemingly limitless memory, I personally believe it's our human memory and our learning processes and also our ability to adapt that really does set us apart. That said, I do also think that AI may potentially evolve the way in which we use our brain. So as somebody who understands the human brain far better than the vast population, what are your thoughts on how we might evolve in response to this technological shift?
What a great question again. So we have in my lab been using machine learning, a type of AI, for probably 5 years to really extract a lot of information out of this high-frequency neurophysiologic data. And as you know, we're able to predict things like sales bumps from advertising and hit songs and this sort of high 90% accuracy range. So one question is, can we get perfect prediction? And the short answer from a neuroscience perspective is no. There's some underlying randomness in the brain that is not fully understood, but it's kind of keeping the pipes open. This is why occasionally you may just drive home a different way. Now you tell yourself a story, well, the sun was setting, I thought it'd be pretty, but your brain has this underlying randomness. So that's a good thing. That means, you know, we're never able to predict perfectly what people will do. That randomness also means that occasionally we make unexpected, weird leaps, like you do sometimes when you sleep on a problem. So when we look at AI techniques, most of those are averaging. So if you've looked at sort of generative AI text, for example, or video or art, it has this little bit of an uncanny feel to it right now because it's too averaged out. It lacks that human unusualness, uniqueness, spark. And so the thing that really helps us as humans is this really weird leaps that are very difficult to get in data that is by design, you know, taking lots of data and therefore kind of averaging everything. I think one of the benefits of AI to humans, besides, you know, better prediction and really helping us understand data, is that we can automate a lot of tasks that just are not fun to do. And therefore, as I said earlier, take that walk, take that long shower, let our brains kind of percolate in an unfettered way and look for those giant leaps at innovation and creativity.
So that's what humans are really good at.
Yeah, it's really what we do, you know, and obviously, you know, it varies. Some people are really good at that and some people maybe struggle, but having the time, like think of the tasks you do that just could be automated. I think about driving. Why are we letting humans pilot 5,000 pound pieces of metal at each other? Like that sounds like a crazy thing to do. So once we automate driving, then I can sit in the back of a pod and think about whatever cool thing I'm working on, right? So that'll be awesome.
And, you know, I imagine that the beautiful thing about that in relation to your work is that so much of what you have zoned in on from, you know, connection to generosity, to trust and belonging, in addition to creativity and experiencing those kind of great leaps that you just spoke about, is that I am hoping that AI will open up a lot more space for humans to really embody those things and lean into all of those things that create this, you know, this wonder and awe within how we think and within how our body responds to what it is to belong and all the things you do.
Well, that's a very wonderful thought. Does it worry you as a human being, as a business person, that we are making something magical obvious, right? When we use these AI techniques, we're taking, you know, we might explain love, we might explain fear, and maybe it removes the magic. Or no, does it make the magic even more magical?
Look, I mean, in my view, I think it makes it more magical. And I think we have this wonderful opportunity to create spaces for humans to really, really come together and to use our creativity and our original thought to genuinely focus in on the solutions that the world needs at this point in time. So I think the fact that we are able to highlight what is so magical is a truly special opportunity that's coming about as a result of this shift. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm optimistic as well. So, I think it's great. And it allows us, again, to really connect. And I think the important research that you know on, you know, democratic societies that have voluntary exchange in business is that it trains us to be service people, right? When we're in business, we're in the service world. And the more we serve others, the more we remember we have to serve our families, we have to serve our friends, just like we have to serve customers. And so I think that service mentality, there's really good research that in these sort of less developed, not even less developed, but sort of small-scale societies, fishing, hunting, whatever, they just don't have this sort of service mentality like we do. So I saw someone on a podcast recently talking about how many times we say thank you. Like, I thank the person at Starbucks and they thank me, and then I thank them again for my change. And it's this voluntary exchange. Like, I'm really happy to get that sort of bad cup of coffee from Starbucks, and they're happy that I'm paying, so they have a salary and a job. And, you know, so it's really about choosing to be a better human being. And I think sometimes in the business world, hopefully it reinforces that. And for extraordinary experiences, it really does. You know, when you have I was traveling recently and I stopped in the middle of nowhere, rural area, at a little diner at a kind of truck stop. And I had this waitress who was, I don't know, mid-40s, overweight. She called me hun. She refilled my iced tea. She could not have been nicer. I have no idea what I ate, but she was a gem. And I gave her a great tip. And anytime I'm in this rural area again, because I have a client there, I will stop at this restaurant because of this wonderful woman who's just, she loved helping me have a better day and probably all of our customers. So how great is that? To me, that's that's
well,
kind
that
of
creates
sharing
a memory,
love.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it creates a memory, desire to return, as we said, customer lifetime value. Yeah. But she really felt like she loved what she did and she shared that love with me. And how great is that?
That's amazing. So in relation to the theme that we just discussed about AI, I came across a quote that I love by Alvin Toffler that says, "The illiterate of the 21st century are not those who cannot read and write, but those who cannot learn, relearn, and unlearn. The future comes too fast and in the wrong order." If this is true, then what has your research taught you about how we can effectively learn, relearn, and unlearn? Because I know you you definitely had a section on learning in the book. So very keen to unpack this with you.
Oh, what a great quote. And it's a question for which I don't have a great answer. I'll give you a little slice of what I know. Learning takes energy. It's difficult for everybody. And we learn at different rates. What we found in publicly, Accenture, big public service, professional services companies use our tech for the last 6 years to optimize the $1 billion they spend a year on upskilling their employees, is that shorter, intensive, high immersion learning opportunities are much more effective when you look at information recall weeks later than are longer, duller opportunities. So really think about three components that influence information acquisition. The first is that human being psychologically safe? Are they comfortable? If it's too cold or you're hungry or you need the bathroom, you're burning bandwidth that doesn't allow you to be as immersed as possible. So first is establish psychological safety. The second is, again, that short intensive structure. So Accenture has broken down their training into 20-minute segments. They found that people cannot stay immersed for more than 20 minutes without a change or a break. That change could be maybe I speak for 20 minutes and then we do table work for 20 minutes, right? It doesn't have to be I'm leaving the room, but I've got to mix it up so the brain kind of restarts because it kind of wants to return to baseline. And the third is the way I deliver it. So I know I've seen some of your talks, Rebecca. You're great when you speak. You have energy. You have that excitement. But you have, and I have, been in workshops, classes, where someone speaks in a monotone. Oh, it's the worst, right? Yes. And so you've got to deliver it with some energy. So again, immersion is contagious. If you're excited as a trainer, as a facilitator, people get excited, right? So, you know, right now I'm spending a lot of metabolic energy because I'm excited to talk to you. It's fun. It's a big part of my life. I hope people pick up on that energy. So psychological safety, structure, and delivery really matter. The last part of your question is a really hard one. How do we unlearn? And usually that's through mistakes. If I'm doing something, I've established some habits, and it fails spectacularly, then I'm motivated to invest the metabolic resources to change what I'm doing. But for most of us, we don't. And I think the more we're in these small, like with social media, there's people I want to listen to, and I want to listen to adverse opinions. And so I think unlearning is really, really hard as well. And I don't know how to optimize that.
Well, you know, and what I'm hearing from what you've just shared is that a lot of this comes down to how much we care, how much we care in relation to how we show up and the energy we bring to, say, our delivery, but also in relation to unlearning, how important is it to us to unlearn a certain behavior or pattern or habit?
Yeah, there is this notion of post-traumatic growth, right? When people have a crisis in their life, they get fired or they get divorced, there is an opportunity to look inside yourself and go, okay, I must be partially responsible for this. Maybe bad things just happen to good people, who knows? But maybe that I can make some changes in my life that will avoid this happening in the future. And so I do think putting ourselves in uncomfortable situations is a great opportunity to have post-traumatic growth, traumatic with a small t here. So travel does that, right? If you're tired, you're hungry, you got to figure out how to get somewhere in a country in which you don't speak the language. When I was doing field work in Papua New Guinea, I'm in the rainforest in the Western Highlands, no bathrooms, no electricity, no running water. You're on your own, right? So, and what happened was I didn't speak the language, but people started holding my hand. They started playing with me. The kids came around. You're like, oh, these are just people. They're just people. And we'll use hand signals and we'll do whatever. And we had a translator at some point, but you know, the translator wasn't always there. And so there's this base human level of just human connection that always works.
So, Paul, with the exponential progress we've discussed and the shift towards remote work, the need for immersive experiences now extends beyond boardrooms. Many of us know the feeling of being brain fried after a day of Zoom calls. And in addition to that, leaders are often tasked with guiding organizations through massive cultural change without face-to-face connection. And in many cases, they can face a degree of resistance to whatever it is they're looking to change within the organization. It's obvious that adaptability is crucial for both leaders and executives at this point in time. And so my question for you is simply this: how can we harness immersion in order to be able to adapt more effectively and to be able to communicate change, especially given we're often in, you know, working in situations where people are working remotely, they're not necessarily in the office, and there are all of these new factors that are influencing how we create adaptability and implement change?
It's such a great question. So what the data look like that we've seen so far, sort of post-COVID, looks like 2 to 3 days in the office is optimal. So I do want people to be in the office because we have these unscheduled interactions and we can build social relationships more effectively than scheduling a meeting with you, you know, on video conference. So yes, office is still important. The second is, if you really have a highly distributed hybrid work group, from a leadership perspective, you need to either be on the road and see them in person or have them get together. It looks like at least once a month. Now, if you're saving money, not paying for office space, you can afford to fly at least some of those people in for an in-person on-site or off-site meeting for a day or two. The value of that is actually very high, both neurologically and productivity-wise. It's just easier to work with people that you've actually spent more time with, you've built relationships with, and building relationships on Zoom, you can do it. It's just not the same. There's just a lot more bandwidth hitting your brain when you're meeting in person. So yeah, if we're going to be hybrid, then we got to travel.
So Paul, as you know, this podcast is very much centered around the concept of purpose. And in our first conversation, last time I interviewed you, we really went into the nuts and bolts on that. But for the purposes of a potentially new audience that might not have heard about your work before, I wanted to just loop back into that conversation a little bit. I think one of the things that I have landed on is that whilst it can be useful to have a neatly articulated statement of why, if we're not actually experiencing the feeling of purpose, that sense of fulfillment that really moves us from the inside out, and that I think is a much deeper, more visceral experience than simply thinking about or knowing your why. Is there a way to create the immersive conditions within ourselves that allow us to really experience and to tap into the feelings of purpose beyond simply being able to, you know, share that why or say what it is?
Yeah, it's very difficult. So I think of this, again, from the sort of health span, happiness perspective. There are really five pillars that we can control that substantially increase our flourishing. Diet, exercise, sleep, having a rich social network, we have an app that help you do that, and knowing your sense of purpose. So what does it mean to be part of the world that creates value for you and for others? So when we look at people's purpose statements, they're often, almost always, other regarding. So even if you want to be the world's best, I don't know, rock climber, you're going to train with other people. You're going to have to hang out with other people, which means they're going to help you, you're going to help them. So one way to think about finding your own personal purpose statement is, what activities do you do or might you want to do that give you energy that involve other people, right? So again, maybe I want to be a rock climber, but how do I, I'm going to join a team. I've got to join a gym. I've got to get professional training, whatever that is. So think about that as energy. I'm sort of obsessed now with energy. So what gives you energy? So besides work and family, what turns you on? What gives you, what makes you get up early on a Saturday and go out and do something? And often it's things you're doing with other people, and that's great. And to the extent that that can be part of, you know, service, so you can see this as service, then I think it's very much reinforcing. For organizations, as you said earlier, that purpose of the organization has to be alive. It's got to be on every employee's tip of their tongue all the time. We've got to talk about it. We've got to know why we exist as an organization, just like you want to know as a human being why you exist. Why am I here on the planet? Eat good food, reproduce, I don't know, watch movies, and maybe make the place just a little bit better. And those purpose statements generally are bigger than just being about your own self.
So, Paul, I'm coming close to the end of our conversation today, but I'm really curious to ask you something. I was reading the other day that recent advancements in neuroscience have led to the creation of the largest and most detailed atlas of human brain cells and the most detailed map ever made of the brain itself. I am guessing that this must be fairly exciting for you. And so I'm curious to know where you think your studies and research will take you next, especially with the emergence of, you know, what is an incredible map of the human brain.
Right. I think so. It is very exciting. I think it's looking at networks now. So as I sort of said earlier, the brain has this inherent nonlinearity and randomness. And so once we establish how you move, how you speak and all that's great, that's pretty well known. Where's that creativity come from? Where's the sense of awe? Where's that amazing experience that we have? Even some things that we just talked about, crying at movies. What the heck is that about? If you're cognitively intact, you're aware it's a movie, you know you're in a theater. So I think, you know, these profound, powerful statements that human beings have are something that are out of the norm. And when we identify where those come from, I think we will be able to live longer, better, happier lives. And we can share that with others and make society better as well. At least that's my hope.
I love that. So, Paul, my last question for you today, and I have to say, there is so much more I could have unpacked with you today. I feel like I have, you know, really only just scratched the surface. However, now seems like the perfect time to discuss the power of love and a really beautiful place to end the podcast. In your book, you mentioned that immersive experiences create connections and enhance the quality of life, and that love itself is an immersive experience. So what I would love to know is, as the love doctor, what do you believe moves us away from love, and how can we continually remind ourselves of the power of this fundamental force that binds us together?
Oh, what a great way to end. It's often fear that moves us away from love. Fear of being seen as weird, fear of being rejected. Love is a leap of faith. And on the other hand, I think when we, particularly when we get old enough, I have four or five male friends that I tell them I love them all the time. And they know what that means. It's not a weird thing, like as the philia sense, as brothers. And, you know, not to say that to your family, to your children, I think is losing a real opportunity to reinforce that. So my rule is that I'm going to say I love you to one person a day at a minimum. That's easy, right? Could be a friend, could be a spouse, could be a kid, but actually make sure that we remind ourselves that love is really the ultimate kind of service to others, right? That means that you're more important than me. And so once I understand that, at least for like my kids, I will always be, I don't care what you do, I will always be there 100% of the time.
Yeah.
I don't care. You need me and I'm in some weird country, I will fly home, right? I want you to know that 100% of the time. So that builds solid relationships and you know, creates the value in me as well. So it's not selfish, it's reciprocal.
Well, I can certainly say that the DNA of Purpose community absolutely love you. And it's been such a joy to have you back. You are always so kind, so generous with your time, Paul. I just feel really, really grateful to have had the chance to interview you again. Where can we find you? Where can we buy the book? Where can we do all of the things?
Wonderful. The book you can find on Amazon or any online source, Immersion, The Science of the Extraordinary and the Source of Happiness. You can find me at getimmersion.com and our free emotional fitness app you can find at besttuesdayever.com.
Amazing. I will be downloading that today. Thank you so much for joining me on the DNA of Purpose podcast.
Thanks so much, Rebecca.
Thank you, as always, for dedicating your time to the DNA of Purpose podcast. As we conclude today's episode, I invite you to extend the conversation online. Feel free to reach out via LinkedIn or follow along at Rebecca Maklad, that is M-A-K-L-A-D, on Instagram, where we're crafting a tapestry of stories, reflections, tools, and insights to empower your purpose-driven leadership strategy. I love feedback, and we always welcome guest suggestions. Should today's episode ignite a spark within you, reviews really do help us to continue to attract the world's most prominent purpose-driven leaders as our guests. And if you know somebody who would benefit from one of our episodes, then share that story with abundance. A big thanks to Supernova Tribe, who produce this podcast with style, and Guide Your Light, a network for podcasts with purpose.